Hey, it is part two of Socialist Shelves Left Behind episode, and if you haven't listened to last week's, that would mean you need to go back and listen to it, because you're going to be kind of confused. We're going to be talking about Tim LaHaye, Jerry B. Jenkins. You're going to say, who are these guys? Not the best people in the world. Anyway, if you are enjoying the show, please follow us on social media at Socialist Shelf. Please send us an email, socialistshelf@gmail.com. Or, you know, just rate us and subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. And without further ado, hopping back into the Left Behind episode.
And you really get a sense of his sort of view of bourgeois democracy as well, as opposed to, you know, something more populist in nature. Because, again, Nikolai, you know, you leave out all the conspiracy stuff. You leave out all the bribery and skullduggery behind it. The people love Nicolae Carpathia. He is made president of Romania by a unanimous vote in their Congress, and then everybody in the country unanimously says, "Yeah, we're cool with this." He commands the greatest consensus it is possible for a leader to command in any country, anywhere. And somehow that's weird.
There's the concept of the dangerous majority,
mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, despite calling themselves the moral majority in the 1970s and 80s, the moral majority movement that Tim LaHaye forms and comes out of and represents is a movement that A, is not the majority of people, because the majority of people are not evangelical Christians, and does not properly claim to be the majority of people, nor do their politics align with that. They are always trying to, you know, wrangle more, more power for votes in areas that are more, that lean towards them. They're always trying to make the voting laws, you know, ranked in their favor, that sort of thing. They acknowledge that they have a lower subsection of the population. They have a problem with democracy. They have a problem with the idea of this sort of mass control. They are afraid of the population, of the masses of people. And they believe eventually, both literally in the sense of it is destined, and also in their own political lives due to their own material interests, that the masses of people will one day embrace actual Satan, risen from hell, incarnate, who will reign over the earth for 7 years.
Yeah, and it's interesting how, because I mean, this idea of the tyranny of the majority goes back to the founding fathers, right? It goes back to this idea that, well, you know, we can't set up a democracy that allows the will of the largely unpropertied, less privileged people to dictate what we can and can't do with our property. You know, John C. Calhoun, Nancy McLean points this out in Democracy in Chains, is one of the intellectual like titans of this sort of libertarian idea, you know, the idea that property is rights, and the more property you have, the more rights you have. These arguments have been getting made since you know, black people were property in this country.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. That's exactly the way it argues, and it's the way it feels. And I don't want to jump the gun too quickly, because there's a little more plot. But I'm going to come back to this, because big thing I'm taking out of the book is related to this and its relationship with the moral majority. But to hop back over, Rayford has conversion to Christianity. He meets a guy named Bruce, who's a pastor at the church. The whole church disappeared, but the associate pastor didn't, because he didn't really believe. He never really, really believed. I honestly find that to be a compelling and interesting character choice that they do absolutely nothing with. And as someone who reads the rest of the books, they never do. He just becomes a mouthpiece for LaHaye. And they have to have him, because they have to have a guy knowledgeable about the Bible to sort of spill the Bible facts. They could have done it a lot better. I like the idea of a guy who just says, oh, shoot, I've been left behind and I know dang well why. You know, like, that is interesting. It's just, it's not done very competently. So now Rayford is... he's converted to Christianity. He watches this tape, actually, that is the final thing that converts him. And it's a tape from the former head pastor addressing people post-rapture, because he's so certain the rapture is going to happen. And what's interesting is Tim LaHaye's company actually ended up making real versions of this tape. They exist. They're out there in the world. They're on YouTube. They sell versions of them. They're post-rapture tapes.
Can we watch one of these?
What'd you say?
Can we watch one of these?
I have not seen one. I need to. I really should have in preparation for this. I have to imagine it's the exact same lines from the book. But yeah, it's out there though. Post-rapture tapes. I imagine they're not very updated with their times unless they've continuously done them. They're probably still mentioning like, you know, VHS and stuff, but yeah, it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
So Rayford converts, and then he has his daughter Chloe, who we haven't mentioned. And here's the thing about Chloe, she's not much of a character.
Yeah,
most of these characters aren't much of characters, but she really isn't much of a character.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, it's the issue that this book has with its female characters in general. You know, they're more foils for the progression of the male protagonists,
psyche.
Yeah. Yeah, basically just Rayford. You know, Buck's kind of there. Buck has his own kind of moment of conversion that we'll get into. But yeah, Chloe's really there just to be, you know, the skeptic, just to provide that kind of friction with her father. Because, you know, she says, why would a loving God do this? But ultimately she does come around.
Yeah, she converts, and it's, you know, it's kind of a struggle, and it just sort of, yeah, she comes around. It's again, it's not overly interesting. And Chloe, you know, she's, I think, 20 years old, college student. So they kind of play the, oh, she's the college student from California. She's got the weird liberal ideas, whatever. Okay, now she's a Christian. I think that's done.
And they really don't go in. They really don't get too into the weeds of what that represents. So like, oh, like she's listening to loud music. Oh, she's, you know, associating with you know, this, that, or the other type of person. Like there's like a thing mentioned where like she gets too drunk and comes home and throws up and whatever. But like it's
there's the mention that everyone in California believes it was aliens.
Really? Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, she says everyone in California thinks it was aliens. He's like, well, of course everyone in California thinks that.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, they don't.
Which like not that unreasonable when something like this happens.
Yeah, I mean, because what do you think? You know.
Yeah. We'll note the movie does have. It's very funny. She has a nose ring at the beginning of the movie, and to show character growth, she doesn't have a nose ring anymore. It's a very amusing thing they threw in there that the book dropped the ball on including something like that. But it's very much the energy you get from the character of Chloe. And that's the only energy you get from her because there was just almost nothing there. There was almost nothing there in any of these characters. I will say like their internal monologues, the way they talk, it's all very similar. There's like a little flash of a little, you know, cockiness of a certain type in Buck and a little bit of, rigidity in Rayford, but hey, they all sound the same way. The only character that sounds different than everyone is Bruce, and that's because he's being written verbatim by Tim LaHaye.
Mm-hmm.
Nikolai Carpathia has a bit of his own sound, but he's in such a different context that I don't feel like that really counts. All the normal characters talk to each other basically the same way. At least all the
especially
normal
when they all start converting.
Oh yeah, once they've all started converting, they lose all personality. Like they are husks of themselves. It's not a great look if you're trying to convert people, to be honest. So the book moves on. Buck comes back. He sees Nikolai speak. He's wowed. There's a moment where Buck thinks he's going to be in trouble with the law. They're going to blame him for the death of his Scotland Yard guy. But then Nikolai's like, I can get you off the hook. I really like you, Buck. And he, you know, he has a whole spiel about the future in this whole interview.
He's very charismatic, and it's weird. It was weird to me because there's a sort of disconnect, right? He's going on the news. He's saying all these things about, well, we need to feed the hungry. We need to disarm. We need to dismantle 90% of all the weapons, surrender the remaining 10% to the UN. And then there can be this body that enforces world peace until even the UN disarms. You know, he's saying all these wonderful things and everybody's like, man, this is really something. This is really, this is what I wish politicians would say. Like, you know, Chloe says that straight up. And to see that right alongside conversations of now we need to watch out for this Antichrist fellow. He's going to be saying a lot of really based things, and he's going to be really charismatic. It's surprising to me that it takes them until like the UN speech to make the connection.
Yeah, they really just like either needed to hide it more or have like a counter figure that could also be the Antichrist. Like they do a better job with Stonicle or something. If they want it to be a mystery at all, like I think the book thinks you're trying to figure it out. And I just don't think there's anyone who's ever read it who didn't figure it out. Like the first mention of Nikolai Carpathia, basically.
Oh yeah. When it says, oh yeah, Chaim Rosenzweig met this guy and was really impressed with him. And
we're yeah. Like, he was so charismatic, but he was from a small country and he was, yeah. Come on. Nikolai Carpathia, though, most interesting character in the book, has the best scene in the book, I'd say, and best scene in the movie. Also worth noting, quick backstory from one of the prequel novels, Nikolai Carpathia actually gets his powers as the Antichrist by Satan coming to him personally and giving him these same trials Jesus went through in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights when he didn't eat. And then, you know, Satan says, I'll give you food if you just worship me. I'll give you the kingdoms of the earth if you just worship me. And Nikolai Carpathia, instead of doing what Jesus did and rejecting him, just takes up the deal. He's like, oh, all the nations of the world now have to do is bow to you? Yeah, I'm down. So it's that's kind of interesting. I like the parallel with Jesus and being literally the Christ.
Yeah, that's narratively pretty cool.
And actually the best Left Behind book is book 3, Nikolai, in my opinion. And that's because it's just like one long action sequence. Jerry is actually fairly competent at when he needs to be.
Man, I don't want to be sold on reading this next one, but
no, don't be sold on it. Really don't. It's not worth it. It's not that good. It's just, it's got its moments where it's like they're running away in like the desert and it's like kind of they're getting chased by global community officers and their helmets and stuff. I think a bus gets blown up. It's a whole thing. World War III, lots of stuff.
Oh yeah. I forgot about that. That's around the corner.
Yeah. Cause there's the four horsemen of the apocalypse. They're going to go through all the seven trumpets, the seven seals. Some of it very literally. Like when it says demons will rise from this abyss and they'll like have the hair of women and like the bodies of locusts and the tails of scorpions, that's literal. But when it says, I don't know, the whore of Babylon will arise and there will be a great beast with like four heads. Unfortunately, that has to be symbolic. And it's just like a random guy who's like a stand in for the Pope.
Well, I mean, you already got demons in this book. Why not go all the way?
Just, you know, like you were getting somewhere. It is weird what they choose to take literally and not. And a lot of this book is just kind of trauma porn as they just go through the plagues of God upon the earth. You know, and I know they kind of have to. They're going through the book of Revelation. You got to run through the plagues. But like that is a weakness of the series going forward is it's like, all right, what's the next awful thing? Oh, it's boils today. Boils. Oh, next thing. What is it? Oh, it looks like the water is blood now. That kind of thing.
This would work so much better as a series of interviews. You ever read World War Z?
No, I did not. I didn't even see the movie, honestly.
It's you're not missing much. The movie's terrible. It was passed around between like five different writers, and it was in development hell for years, and it really shows. Like it's very sloppy. But the book, despite, you know, it's not a perfect book, you know, there's certain aspects of geopolitics that it doesn't really mirror realistically, but the format would be great for a Left Behind because it's people from all over the world dealing with, in this case, a zombie outbreak, and surviving the aftermath of it and telling how they, you know, where they were when it all kicked off and how they managed to get through it, you know, and
hear me out. The narrator of the book is Buck Williams. They're all in heaven in the 1,000-year reign of God, okay? And they're all getting interviewed on the apocalypse. Buck now goes by Cameron because there's nothing left to Buck, but he says, back in those days, I was Buck Williams, star reporter. You've got something there, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? Yeah, and you don't even have to, you know, make that like a framing device. You don't have to linger on like him being in heaven too long. Although
you know, they're not heaven, actually, the 1,000-year reign of Christ, technically different.
Yes,
it gets complicated, very complicated. In fact, there's a whole book set during the 1,000-year reign, and it's the worst book because there's no conflict.
It's just 1,000 years of just Jesus ruling, and it's pretty neat.
They're chilling, and there's like they're still not like perfect yet because they hasn't been like the perfect conversion yet. But so they're still like trying to, here's the thing. They're still trying to convert people to Christianity. Because for some reason, some people don't become Christians. And in the book series, everyone who doesn't become a Christian dies on their 100th birthday and goes to hell. And then at the end, Satan rises up one more time, tries one more try at God. And then
do they get to live to be 100?
Yeah, they live to the exact age of 100 and they die on their 100th birthday if they don't convert. If you do convert, you live the entire time. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, I'm turning that over in my head. Well,
it's okay. It's neither here nor there. It's just it's called Kingdom Come, and it's the worst book in the series.
Okay.
But yeah. Regardless, let's finish out this book. My bad. I got us off there. But
yeah, no, we got talking.
What do we have left? Buck gets basically confronted by the gang because they all know each other from the airport, and they're like, "Hey, Buck, buddy, you really need to become a Christian, and here's why."
Yeah, and Buck's there because he wants to interview Rayford and get like his perspective on what he thinks is the cause of all this.
You kind of get the whole spiel again a little bit.
Yeah, because you had to go through that conversion process with Rayford and with Chloe and with Buck.
And you hear Bruce's too. You really, really happens four times in the book.
Yeah, yeah. Is Hattie a Christian by the end of it?
No, I don't think so.
No, yeah, she's going off and doing her own thing.
Spoiler alert for anyone who cares, but Hattie ends up getting killed by fire called from the sky when she converts and confronts Nikolai in the streets of Jerusalem, and he calls fire from the sky and turns her into ashes. She has one of the most metal endings in the series.
Yeah, well.
This book series is wild, man. I don't know. It's so crazy.
Does she at least go to heaven?
Yeah, no, she's converted.
Okay.
She converts after, I think, getting impregnated by Nikolai, but that's a whole different thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the Antichrist child and all that. Yeah. That's a whole thing.
Cause
so, yeah.
Like by the end of this book, she's like Nikolai's personal assistant somehow. I honestly kind of missed why. Do you remember why is she his assistant now?
I don't exactly remember the inciting incident of that. All I know is that like it's she steps from a career in aviation to being his assistant. Like I just get the sense that she's the best I can remember is that, you know, she likes him same as everybody else. And well, it's a similar reason, for example, that like Buck's immediate superior at the paper goes to be Nikolai's personal press secretary. Right. Because, wow, this guy's one in a million. You know, I better go and be in his orbit.
Yeah, it's in the movie. It like streamlines it by Buck and her knowing each other. And he gets her a job at the UN and she meets him there. Mm-hmm. And the book, it's like a pretty big jump from like flight attendant to UN to personal secretary slash like lover of Nikolai Carpathia. But you know, it's that kind of happens and she's in a dangerous orbit. And Buck, you know, he gets called to this massive meeting of world leaders where Nikolai is going to do a big thing. And on his way there, he has this conflicted moment, but he decides to convert when he sees all the evidence laid out before him that there's going to be a 7-year treaty and all this crazy stuff. And then you finally get the best moment of the book, in my opinion. You want to give us the rundown of that, Joss?
Yes, 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 yes. So, well, there's two best moments, right? You know, you have that moment where Nikolai is making the speech at the UN, you know, and he's talking about UN's history and he's got an encyclopedic knowledge of its workings and of the people involved in its creation. There's a part where he says, yeah, and you know, the UN's got all these member countries, you know, countries like Afghanistan, Andorra, you know, and he goes down this list and names every single country in the world. And it starts, you know, it starts small and it gets louder. People are standing on their feet and applauding by the end. It's really cinematic. And it's really a brilliant little bit of speech writing. You know, he's won over the entire room, really the entire global community by the end of it. So there's, so he has that moment. And then when Buck's going to be the fly on the wall and report on Nikolai's big proposal to the UN, the closed doors proposal, where he's like, okay, we're gonna expand the Security Council, and these people are gonna have more or less unchecked power within their respective areas of the world. That's where John Stonegal and the other bank dude, Todd Cawthorne, is in attendance, right? And that's where any notion that they are the man behind the man and that they have the power is dispelled, because Nikolai straight up ices these guys.
Oh yeah, just takes the security guard's gun and bam,
gone. And it's really Gordon Curry plays Nikolai Carpathia in the original Left Behind film, and he delivers the best, most chilling performance in the movie.
Yeah, easy.
Like, I unironically like it.
No, it's a good moment, and I believe he's actually played some like B horror movies, and you kind of see that come through.
Yes.
And then the whole room has seen it, but then Nikolai uses his powers of satanic deception to make them all believe they saw a murder-suicide. Buck is the only one who's not fooled because he's Christian at this point, which is interesting enough, because then later on, his boss gets really mad at him and is like, hey, dude, why didn't you go to the biggest meeting of all time? And he was like, I was there. And he's like, no, you weren't. No one saw you there. And Buck actually ends up getting demoted and kicked back to Chicago, which is basically useful because the main characters live in Chicago. So I think it was more just for the writer's sake that they could just send Buck to Chicago permanently. But, you know, it works. And you're already seeing, you know, his decision to become a Christian cost him in his personal life.
Yeah.
And the idea is it's going to cost them a lot more because, you know, there's going to be literal oppression and eventually mass guillotining of Christians.
And lest we forget, isn't the timeline of this book 2 weeks from the rapture to Nikolai Carpathia becoming king of the UN?
Something like that. It's a couple weeks.
Yeah, it's very, very short.
And in the second book, Tribulation Force, there's a few months before Nikolai signs the treaty with Israel, like officially signs it, and then the 7 years are kicked off. It's like 7 years plus some change that this series covers.
Gotcha. Okay.
And the book ends with basically them being like, we need to found a paramilitary.
Yeah. That was wild. I mentioned this to you the other day. It's wild to me that, you know, I'm thinking of Chloe, right? 20-year-old college girl who's skeptical of the whole rapture thing. Who's kind of a Christian, but, you know, not in the like whole hog, like believing in the end of the world, like type that Tim LaHaye is. And she goes from, you know, that to, yeah, I'm gonna die on the battlefield in Jesus's name.
Oh yeah. And the Tribulation Force, they do become a paramilitary. Like they become a paramilitary. Like there is a video game that comes out later on, even called Left Behind Eternal Forces, which is a Christian real-time strategy game where you use the Tribulation Force to engage in holy war against your enemies.
And you, like, you can kill people, but, like, it's better if you convert them, right?
It's better to convert them. If you kill people, you lose faith points, and you have to pray to get those faith points back. It's like a morale.
Oh, okay. So, like, I mean, you can just... I imagine you can just like math that out and be like, okay, if I kill X number of people, then I'll pray for Y rounds, you know?
I mean, basically it's the spirit level drops. Game wasn't nothing. Came out in, I believe, 2006. It had its own expansion pack. The original game cost $5 million to make. I mean, it wasn't a nothing, you know? I mean,
what do you do in the expansion pack? Do you fight like the Norse gods?
That would be awesome. I couldn't find out much information about it, but, I know it was supposed to have a proper sequel, and then the game Rise of Nations, I believe, the sequel to Rise of Nations basically used some of its content as an actual just different game.
Wow,
which is very weird.
Funny how these things happen.
Yeah, this, you know, they had some stuff lying around, and they were like, well, no one bought this game, no one cares. Because it's 2006, Left Behind is old hat. No one cares about Left Behind in 2006.
I'm reminded, this is totally off topic. You ever read about that one like Noah's Ark game that's basically just a reskin of Wolfenstein?
I've heard of it. I need to like watch gameplay of it.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Look it up.
There's a newer game called I Am Jesus. Have you seen that?
No, I'm not familiar.
You play as Jesus and you just do miracles and until your miracle meter runs out and you have to wait for a comeback. It's not good. And it's a first person. So you're seeing through the eyes of Jesus. Very wild. There's some wild Christian games out there. None, however, will top the Flash games on VeggieTales website that closed down in 2012.
Oh, I never knew about the VeggieTales website. And I grew up with VeggieTales.
Oh, they had some fire Flash games. I have to say, you had Larry Boy and you would like swing around. It was awesome. At least I remember it being awesome. And now I'll never know if it wasn't because the site doesn't exist anymore. Mm. But to get back on topic, though, you know, VeggieTales is always worth talking about. But to be back on topic, yeah, that's basically where the book concludes. You know, our main characters are saved. You have four people that are your main characters. And that is not an accident, by the way, because by the end of the world, the Bible says, well, in their reading of the Bible, 3/4 of humanity will die within the 7-year tribulation. And in the time, in the moment in which each of those quarters are supposed to die, LaHaye and Jenkins kill off a character.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. Bruce dies in World War III. When Chicago gets nuked, I believe.
There's a few of that happening. Yeah.
Chloe gets decapitated for not taking the mark of the beast. And Buck dies Uzi in hand in the Battle of Armageddon. Rafer survives.
Oh, of course he does. Jesus.
Yeah, because he's Rayford Steele. Why wouldn't he?
That's, yeah. And like, you like Rayford less and less as you go through the book, right? Because he doesn't really shed the, like, he's, once the rapture happens, you know, and he realizes, oh, my wife was right, like, he's like, okay, well, I realized I was wrong to lust after Hattie. Like, I only wanted her for her body, you know, this, that, and the other. But, like, you know, he still can't come out and, I mean, he's still trying to shift some of the blame off on her when they're talking, you know?
Sure.
And it's...
he's wild, and you hate him even more in the next book because he remarries.
Yeah.
Which is insane. Like, especially in the context of this book, and especially knowing you're going to see your wife in 7 years minimum or maximum.
Mm-hmm. Well, by which Chloe point, and Buck, they won't be married anymore.
True. Chloe and Buck also get married, which is interesting.
Yeah, and they just kind of hit it off. There's not really a, more than a couple of conversations where they kind of back and forth and joke with each other.
You can't really have much of a dynamic in this book because there's so few characters that are actually fleshed out. Like, even Rayford and Buck, who are your perspective characters, are so dry and so mechanical. And so I saw this happen. Wow. I thought, like, it's just, there's so nothing. And the longer it goes and the more Christian they get, the less character they have, which does a massive disservice to Christianity. Like, right. It's why, you know, the character that the only compelling character is the villain. Mm-hmm. Because they can't be interesting if they're going to be, you know, decent characters. And Tim LaHaye isn't even bold enough to have his characters who will become good be bad to start with. They still have to be basically decent guys to start off the novel. Like, he's too afraid to depict anything explicit. He's too artistically, you know, cowardly to show, oh, here's him cheating on his wife. Here's him. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have, you know, the gumption to do that. So he just kind of has to be guys who their problem are, he was a little arrogant. Oh, he thought a 27-year-old was attractive.
Mm-hmm. And there's that unresolved sexual tension that Rayford just kind of drowns in his newfound zealotry. Like, he's so desperate to find validation from his daughter and to try and convert her into this new truth that he's found.
And it just ends. Yeah.
It just ends.
It just fixes the problem for him. And that's exactly the opposite of what it needs to be doing. It needs to be growth as a character. But however, he's so stale and has made The real mistakes he's made is not being around his family enough, and he focuses on that less and on this affair that never happened more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why didn't they have there be an affair? I don't understand. Like,
yeah,
there
and
should
again,
have been an affair. Like that would.
Again, that's the thing that the movie did better, right? You know, instead of, because you know, you make a mistake, you atone for it, right? But in the book, you just get this, you know, will they, won't they, like, you know, will I, won't I, like internal monologue. And that's not interesting. You know, that's not, you know, we are not the character's therapist. All right. Like it's not interesting.
Feels gross. Like I think they have this idea that if he had cheated on his wife, we wouldn't like Rayford or something. Like the characters have to be likable in some way. They have to be mm-hmm. insert characters in some way. And to do that, they have to be people that audience can put themselves in the minds of. And who do they put them in the minds of? The greatest journalist in the world and the greatest airline captain in the world. And like, I don't know. It's not interesting. It's boring. These guys, Buck is slightly more interesting than Rayford, but Buck's not really that interesting. Buck doesn't have his own line on anything. It's not like Buck is like a reporter who is what? He doesn't have a chip on his shoulder against the global order. He's like dismissive of things about the global order. He's not really a striver either. Like he's like, oh yeah, I got to publish this piece, but you don't have him burning up. Like I have to beat my colleagues. He's just like a guy.
He just happens to get somewhere and have instincts for, oh, you know, I should pull out a microphone. Oh, I should take notes here. Like, you know, he does a inventive thing at the beginning
yes.
where he kind of jacks his phone into his laptop and is able to make calls that way. I didn't really delve into the technology of it too hard, but I mean, he
seems real.
Yeah. And like, he's not a journalist that seeks to do the journalism of, you know, overturning corruption, of exposing anything materially wrong with society. There's no real theory of bucking authority, of upsetting, you know, the powers that be.
Yeah.
Despite his nickname, you know, this stood out to me. Like, I've forgotten a fair chunk of the prose in this book, even just having finished it earlier this week. But like, what will stick with me always is his habit of, you know, oh, I travel light. I only take one suit and I wash it in the sink of my hotel room. just to shave as much time off of his schedule as possible, just to shave as much weight off of his traveling as possible.
But he's not even like a striver. Like you could have even been like, yeah, because he's a striver. He's a hustler. No, not really. Like
it's just the nerdiest shit.
He works hard to get back to New York because like his boss tells him to.
Yes.
And, like he doesn't even buck his boss. Like
his boss. I remember this now. His boss sends out a mass email to the workplace, the staff that says, hey, hunker down where you can, keep reporting from where you are. And we'll get through this. And then he sends that message to Buck, like, Buck, disregard everything I just said. You come here. You're special and we need you on this.
Right. You don't see Buck be special. I don't know. We hardly see even any examples of his writing. Like, you know, he's supposedly a great writer. We don't really ever get to see a point where he does that. Maybe he would have been bucking authority if he had come to New York. Despite that being refused. And then his boss looks at him and goes, damn it, Buck, you break the rules, but you're a good reporter.
You're a loose cannon
here. You play by your own rules, but man, we need you. Like that would have made sense. Instead, they're like, yeah, his name's Buck Williams. Just believe he's a firebrand.
Yeah,
his name's
Rayford.
Rayford Steele.
The only real pushback that Buck gets is so he can be martyred.
Yeah, it's
right at the end.
It's yeah, exactly. And it's, and that's honestly, you know, it's fine. It's good. It's whatever. It's just, and it's not, you know, it's just, there's no way you can relate with these characters. And I know they're supposed to be self-insert enough that the reader can feel preached to, but that's not a good way to write a book. This isn't a book of theology. This is supposed to be like an action novel. And it blows my mind that so many people read it as such and enjoyed it as such. But, you know, maybe they were just really bored in 1995. I don't know.
Yeah, could be. I quite like the it's funny because like Jenkins, again, he's a serviceable enough prose writer. You know, he's just working from a really, what you get the sense is a really tendentious outline. You told me straight up when you were introducing this to me, look, he's just doing this for a check. And I have a quote right here that I think sums it up pretty well.
Is this maybe your favorite quote from the novel?
Yes, it is. Yes, okay. It is. And maybe it's just because of the context that you gave me to look at it in, but I couldn't help but notice. Buck couldn't take his eyes, heavy as they were, off the screen as image after image showed disappearances caught on home recorders. From some countries came professional copies of live television shows in progress, a host's microphone landing atop his empty clothes, bouncing off his shoes, and making a racket as it rolled across the floor. The audience screamed, one of the cameras panned the crowd, which had been at capacity a moment before. Now several seats were empty, clothes draped across them. Nothing could have been scripted like this, Buck thought, blinking slowly. If somebody tried to sell a screenplay about millions of people disappearing, leaving everything but their bodies behind, it would be laughed off.
Yeah.
You know, that's funny. And in the business of writing, in the business of ghostwriting, like I am, maybe this is just anecdotal, right? But you get the sense that okay, somebody's taking a moment to be a little tongue in cheek with the prompts that they've been handed.
Yeah, and it's Tim and LaHaye would never be tongue in cheek. It's J.K. Yeah. Jenkins.
Also, I'll point out that paragraph that I just read about live TV shows showing disappearances and whatnot. That's about as much engagement as we get with the actual event happening.
Yes. Just so little. And it's not like an awfully written scene, but like you'd think the whole thing, or at least the first half of it would be that, but we see very little of it actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
You'd like to, in a book with multiple perspectives, maybe see it from multiple perspectives, but unfortunately you start the book with both of them in the same place and neither of them see it happen. You know, maybe if you had a Chloe perspective and she was, I don't know, at the mall or something, and there's an instant pandemonium or she's driving or, you know, you could see something come out of that.
Yeah, you know, as it is, like, she's just introduced, like, you know, because her father's worried about her.
Right, and as it is, Rayford and Buck, both of them, they don't sleep through it literally, but they both miss the rapture directly. They don't see it happen. I'll go ahead and read my favorite quote from the novel, and this is from when Rayford arrives home and finds his son and wife missing, And he's in his son's room, his son's Raimi's room. And it's like, and I was so starved for moments of character. This one moment of character I actually kind of enjoyed. It's this.
Oh, yeah.
He laid his clothes in a neat pile and noticed a picture of himself on the bed table. This is of his son's bed table. He stood smiling inside the terminal, his cap tucked under his arm, a 747 outside the window in the background. The picture was signed "To Raimi with Love, Dad." Under that, he had written, "Rayford Steele, Captain, Pan Continental Airlines, O'Hare." He shook his head. What kind of dad autographs a picture for his own son? Like, that's I like that. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I think that should be Rayford. Like, that's, if Rayford was that guy all the time, he would be a lot more of an enjoyable character. The guy who autographs pictures to his own kid. Like, that's funny. That's good. You know, and that's a guy who does need to repent.
Yeah. You know? He for the those moments of being a dad, those moments of being in a of having familial relationships and committing to them, because the whole book you just get wall to wall, you know, how he just slowly lost interest in his wife, and oh, you know, he still loved her on some level, but like, you know, especially there's a bit about a third of the way through where he's thinking about how his wife just got, you know, more and more like distant and weepy because she was having a really difficult pregnancy. And it's like, and, you know, that's when he started like drinking and staying out. And it's like, you know, God forbid you have any interest in your wife's suffering.
Good right. God. Exactly. And also like very, the son is almost not, is not important either. Raimi, like the wife gets talked about in that context. Raimi gets almost ignored. Like,
oh yeah,
who he was, what he was like. He was the kid who every now and then said, "Dad, will you come to church?" And he said, "No." Like, that's one of your only moments of Raimi, is he has like a signed picture of his dad by him. And I liked that. And I thought, okay, so, you know, dreaming of how you punch this up, he's like, I failed with Raimi. I'm not going to fail with Chloe, you know, or at least in my relationship as a father, that kind of thing.
There is a part where I really, that I do appreciate, where it's like, oh, you know, he found Raimi's clothing in his bed because he'd been raptured, and his socks were there as well, you know. And there's a moment, and I wish we'd seen it in the film at least. They wouldn't even had to explain it in the film, but they could at least have socks there for somebody who had read the book to be like, oh yeah, they noticed that, because that's the because that's kind of the dynamic that is mentioned, is that the mom would always try to get Raimi to wear his socks to bed. God only knows why. But Raimi never did that. But you know, in this last moment, he was like, okay, mom.
You made the right call.
Yeah, you know,
last night.
And yeah, exactly. And I like what that represents, but mm-hmm. it's not earned. You know, there's not a greater context in terms of character and in terms of relationships that really fits into.
Well, if you really want the relationships fleshed out, fleshed out, Jerry B. Jenkins did write a prequel novel just about Rayford Steele's home life. You don't want to read it.
I was about to say, like, you're going to spend this whole podcast like surreptitiously recommending the rest of the books to me.
You're not gonna read. You just you it cannot even tell you how much you don't want to read this one. Oh, there's not even the rapture. It's called Rapture, though.
That can be our trade. If I read another one of these books, you have to read some of H.P. Lovecraft's most racist stories.
I will read anything by H.P. Lovecraft before I read more of these. Because at least here's the thing: at least H.P. Lovecraft, whatever he was rocking with, whatever ideology he was rocking with, is like so arcane and weird that like it is like changed in there's like he had this like weird almost like monarchism that's just not. This is an alive and well ideology fueling these books.
And it's doing actual damage.
Right. And that's kind of what I wanted to get back to a little bit is, I was saying it earlier, but there is an ideology at the base of these books. And it's directly important because Tim LaHaye is such an important political figure. There is an ideology that says that the world is literally prophesied to end in failure. Like the human project. Sans God will end in failure, and not without God, like not in the sense of, oh, if we all turn to God, we can avoid this. No. There will be no avoiding it. There will be the takeover of the world by the Antichrist. There will be mass acceptance of him. There will be 7 years of hell on earth before the great purge at the end by God. There is no room for what if we make a better world. There is no room for this is a warning. There is no room for, well, you know, at least what the Catholic Church said a long time ago, which is we'll bring about the millennium of Christ. I mean, they did horrible, horrible things, but at least they had a vision for what the world could be. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
A terrible vision, but they had a vision. Like there was a project. This is somehow nihilistic despite being Christian.
Yeah.
Which it shouldn't be possible to be nihilistic if you're a Christian. However, it is a complete fatalism in the human project, a complete fatalism in all politics. The idea that all politics are inherently doomed, the idea that the world will always and inevitably turn on Christians, even if they're ahead, even if the good guys are winning, even if Ronald Reagan is in office, as they see as their great moment, the end is just around the corner. Hell is about to rain on earth. The ruling elites are already planning on enforcing some like false religion on everyone. And there is no point in trying to make the world better. And this world is not our home. This world is not where things will be good. There is an inevitable ending where we will rise into the clouds, either literally or we'll be zapped away or we'll die and we'll be there and we'll have heaven. And whether you believe in heaven or not, that's not my point. My point is, if you really, though, believe in your heart of hearts that heaven is the only way that the earth can get better practically in this world, then like if you believe that this world is doomed, heaven is the only good, then why would you ever try to make this world better?
Exactly.
You wouldn't. You would pursue your narrow interests.
It's a theology based in nihilism, as you say, total insularity, alienation, you know. And you know, right at the end of the tribulation force, right? And you know, I don't know how the rest of the series goes on, but what I see materially is here is a project bringing the world together and solving the world's problems. And what are our protagonists? How are our protagonists relating to it? They're putting together essentially a terrorist group. to try and combat it.
And the thing is, it doesn't even really engage with its own. It's not bold enough, the series, to say it has everything Nikolai Carpathia promises be a lie. He doesn't solve global hunger and stuff.
Sure,
it would have
sure.
been more interesting if they'd actually engaged with that and had him do that and him still be bad. And they could have at least like had some kind of moral reckoning
yes.
with like earthly things versus heavenly things. Like, oh, well, they don't though, because they're not bold enough to do that. They're not going to put their stand down. They're just going to say, not only is it wrong to pursue that, but it can't be achieved because they mm-hmm. don't believe in humanity's ability to achieve good things. However, and here is the wild contradiction in all of it, and I'm going to try not to get too excited. They still are incredibly political. Despite all of these things, despite believing politics are doomed, I mean, Tim LaHaye left his church to pursue politics full time. Wild contradiction.
Well, yeah, and you know the way that they square it as well. You know, there needs to be these conditions on Earth that we bring about, and so you know that's how they tie in this. That's how they syncretize the. That's how they syncretize their particular theology with the perpetuation of American imperialism to have this essentially buffer state in Israel. That you know this homeland that all Jewish people will return to, and then the world ends. You know that's how they justify you know America's continued military project of and hegemony.
Even it's so wild. You know, George W. Bush in an interview about Iraq said, well, maybe this is the beginning of New Babylon.
I mean, that.
Yeah. He even said George W. Bush said that at a certain point.
Wow.
Like that's how pervasive this is. We bombed the heck out of the Middle East. Well, you know, there's a inevitable da 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 da. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you can wash things away, if this world is not your home, and if this world is doomed, then if you pursue your narrow interests here, that's fine, because this is a video game. This is a simulation. This is a prequel before eternity. You know, not just and it would be one thing if they said, okay, this world is not our home, so we're going to do nothing but pursue, you know, the conversion of souls. And no doubt they do pursue the conversion of souls. But why, you know, try and impose their social beliefs? Why try and ban homosexuality as he wanted to do? Why mm-hmm. try and keep women out of the workplace as he tried to do? Why fight for segregation? Why fight for, by any means, why care about what economic system we're under? If you don't care about money, you don't care about material things. Why did you die a millionaire?
Yeah, exactly.
Why did you die amid luxury in your Southern California estate at age 90, Tim LaHaye? Because believe it, I'm not saying Tim LaHaye doesn't believe these things, but I am saying at the end of the day, the people that are the deepest in this culture, and I'm not saying like everyone who's an evangelical or certainly not everyone's a Christian, but the people who are deepest and the most powerful and the most influential and the closest to the levers of power, they know what side their bread is buttered on at the end of the day.
Yes.
And that's why he's willing to get in bed with people like the Moonies. That's why he's willing to, work with the U.S. government and the U.N. when he needed to, despite him saying these are literally going to be the institutions that impose the mark of the beast on all of us.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he's willing to work with the office of president, pursue his own interests in it over and over and over again. That's why he's willing to do all of these things.
Because these institutions and the ability to use them to secure their material dominance over the rest of the world, you know, that is their God. That is what they worship. And if they can come up with a theology for it to capture some kind of mass base to it, you know, so much the better for them.
Right. And it's I've been on the campus of some of these places like Liberty University, like and it looks like a gigantic, like a mall, like a crazy mall from like 2004 at like the height of like that culture, just like made gigantic. It looks like a, you know, a theme park. It's like The Righteous Gemstones is basically a documentary about some of these places. Mm. Like it is pure. It is like this pure materialism where, you know, whether or not they're Calvinists, they do have this belief that like wealth is tied to their election, and the idea that them coming into power and coming into wealth connects them directly to the will of God. And the will of God is expressed in the material forces of the world, despite prosperity the contradiction gospel. That it'll be the opposite one day. Yeah, exactly.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, it is more difficult for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle and for Tim LaHaye to be anywhere but burning in hell right now.
That's exactly right. And that's what it comes down to. And that's why these books are dangerous in certain sense, because like I personally, and I know a lot of people who are more so than me, like literally traumatized by some of this, like literally like thinking the rapture is going to happen and like being afraid for your soul, which like the book doesn't really do to its readers, but like the culture around it does. Mm-hmm. There are movies and stuff made like about, there's like Thief in the Night in the 1970s, which we didn't even mention, but this book actually's name is a callback to a song from that movie. There are like certainly sermons I was privy to as a child where it's like, you know, you never know, one day you might wake up and everyone's gone but you. Like it is, so there is that side of it that's damaging, and there is the alternate side that is about a complete anti-politics, a complete, you know, negation of politics, not the sense of not pursuing a political project and leaving us all alone. That would be fine. But the idea of pursuing a completely self-interested political project, trying to build this sort of weird bubble around your own space.
And encouraging people to retreat into that bubble, you know, people, yes. You know, instead of, you know, getting out into the streets and engaging in a mass people struggle, you know, which struggle has alone delivered any sort of expansion of rights for those people.
Exactly. And that's what it all, you know, it comes back to. And it's a well that you can plumb a lot. And there's a lot of psychology in it. And there's a lot of people who read these books because they're easy reads. And there's, and you know, it is what it is. And it's fine if people even believe in the rapture, this, that, or the other. There is this deep and almost uniquely like American conservative cynicism at the heart of this book and these books. And it is hard to reckon with the message of the book that it comes from. I mean, you even have the Commission on Theology and Church Relations from the Lutheran Church said that the ideas expressed in the Left Behind series are in many ways contrary to the teachings of Holy Scripture, and said, quote, though containing a fictional storyline, the books promote a theology that is, as in important respects, at odds with the biblical revelation, end quote. I mean, it while it does have its like parts of forgiveness and this and that, it has this undertone of this crushing horror and this complete uselessness in the face of God and the complete meaninglessness of the human project and the complete nothingness that is anything you build in this world that is meant to make this world a better place. And that's why like it just feels very sinister to me. Yeah, even though it is very silly on its face.
Yeah, it's, you know, the meaninglessness of everything is stressed of these characters' lives, of everything that came before their turning to this particular brand of God. It's this idea that you have to utterly submit to this turning inward from the rest of the world, you know, only going out into it to try and bring people back in with you. Oh, and by the way, I'm Tim LaHaye. I know exactly how all this stuff should go. So, you know, I have the ear of all these powerful people. I'll talk to them on your behalf. Don't worry. Wink, wink. You know?
Yep. And the organizations he funded are to this day operating very smoothly. They're getting what they want in a lot of places. And, you know, the tradition lives on, it evolves, it changes, it has different forms, people believe different things, but this tradition continues and it will continue to continue until people in practice disprove this kind of idea that that we as a people cannot achieve anything good. We cannot raise, you know, the standard of living. If you want to pull from the book of Revelation, I would encourage you to believe what was believed by Christians for thousands of years, that the book of Revelation warns of an antichrist, it warns of the four horsemen, it warns of horrors at the end of the world, and it promises the grace of God. I would encourage you to take that as what it is, a warning. Let us all be afraid of famine and death and poverty. Yeah, absolutely. And war above all, probably. But let's not, you know, say, and they're going to happen anyway.
Right. Right. You know, because it's, you know, we've discussed this before. Like if Jesus's sole concern was getting people's souls saved and getting people to heaven, why would he have been crucified? Why would the Romans have considered him a threat? You know, it seems to me that he, in his day, was an organizer who tried to drive people to band together and change their conditions on earth, which you can do and which you must do.
Absolutely. Whether you do it through the lens of, you know, theology or not, it's important to note that. And it's important to note, if you want the 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth, then let's make a world for Christ to return to. How about 100%. That? You know, 100%. Let's make a world for the Christ of the Bible to return to and say, well done. That's what I want to see. You know, the Christ didn't just say, okay, I've done the cross. Now I'm going to do Armageddon. No, he left his followers behind with a commission.
It's that fable of the guy who's caught in a flood and somebody comes along with a boat, and there's like three people who come along with boats, and he's like, no, I'm waiting for God to save me. And then he dies, he goes to heaven, and God's like, dude, I sent you like three boats.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the situation. We've got our boats. This is going to be a stretch of the analogy, but we have the boat of the working class. I don't know. That's a stretch. But you know what I'm saying? How about this? We're going to take a third way. We don't support the tribulation force, nor do we support Nikolai Carpathia, but a secret third thing that is the working class of, and we will, we'll make it work from there. How's that? Secret third thing that will save the globe. Hmm. Yes, absolutely. And that's my thoughts on it. Do you have any other thoughts before we close this thing out? I know this has been very me heavy, but if you can't tell, I have a lot of feelings attached to these books.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, you have the background with it. You have the past with it that you're reckoning with. I'm coming at this from the perspective of somebody who, you know, wanted an apocalypse tale that was like compelling in a very like World War Z sense, you know, and you don't get the characters, you don't get the apocalypse itself for the most part, you just get the the least interesting people in the world in the prelude to a truly bizarre struggle.
Yeah, a truly bizarre struggle
that will have implications for themselves and their community and, not the world at large, because, you know, the world's ending, which that's not really interesting in and of itself. You know, no. The end of the world is not interesting in and of itself. You know, you want to see people deal with it. You want to see people adapt to it. Maybe you do see it end, you know, but the important thing is the journey and people forging a life for themselves regardless.
That's absolutely right. And that's what we have to pursue. And at the end of the day, we've got to try and bring about a better world. You know, naysayers be damned. Tim LaHaye, you're gone. But we still got to get rid of the forces he worked with and construed with and built throughout his life. Jerry B. Jenkins, honestly, just like chase your bag. I'm not that mad at you. Just don't write any more books like this. I can't, Jerry, you're hard to love, but you're even harder to hate.
We will end this, you know, and there will one day be, you know, no material basis for him to collect a check from grifters like LaHaye, you know. Yeah. It is not often, I think, that we will end the episode vowing to undo everything that the authors have built, but
that is the case.
This is one of them, but we can't do it alone, guys.
I'm going to, before we hop off, I'm going to posit one quick crackpot theory that I think Tim LaHaye would appreciate if it wasn't directly aimed at him.
Shoot.
LaHaye, just think about this. What president did he serve most directly? Ronald Wilson Reagan. Now count the letters of the name 666. A lot to think about. All I'm saying is, Tim LaHaye, what master did you truly serve?
Aha. Well, there again, you know, Jenkins calls it out in the essay, right? That he thought about making the Antichrist the American president, right? But they were like, you know what? No, he's universally beloved. If the Antichrist were the president, half the country would hate him.
That is true. That's a good point. We will, of course, be eating, you know, eating our words if by the time this has been released, Joe Biden has declared he's moving Washington, D.C. to Babylon. But, you know, we'll see.
We'll see.
All right. See y'all.
All right. Take care.